Good morning and welcome to the Astrology of Now. My name is Eric Francis, here to facilitate a conversation in somewhere in the middle of space time where we are in our non-local, kind of crazy non-local internet world. I'm starting at 12:01, and this is a different kind of a class. It's a participation class more than a technique lecture. So you are who makes this relevant, because it's your observations about your life that are going to teach us what these energies are about. And I think that among us, we can come to some observations about what we're doing here on the planet right now, and in particular, how we're feeling about being here right now. We are in a crazy, over the top moment, and when I scheduled this class, was not expecting it to be quite this crazy, but I guess I could have estimated that. And it seems like we're in an epic moment with a couple of things happening that are really outstanding, including the Uranus-Eris conjunction, which is on this time around on about a 90-year cycle, and then Mars stationing direct right at the same time. So I think that of all the things that are going on, many of which have been developing over a long period of time, for example, Pluto in Capricorn since 2008, the simultaneous quality of this really rare conjunction and Mars, conjunction in Aries and Mars in Scorpio are what gives this moment its real poignancy. And I think also its relevance in terms of using it as leverage to make decisions and to make changes. From really the whole theory of astrology that I bring to the work is, how can we use these events for maximum leverage making decisions? The tradition of astrology is usually about how to predict things, and then, in humanistic astrology, which takes hold, sometime in the 60s, it seems to become more about growth, and psychological astrology is more about character analysis. And what I'm interested in as kind of a public astrologer is making sure that we see these moments as the leverage points that they are. That's the essence of the horoscope, to call out the issues, give them some language, give them some ideas, and then to put that over in your direction so that you can make the best decisions in your environment. And we're in a really radical environment right now, and the astrology, I think, is describing it. There was a video that I sent around which kind of describes the astrology that describes the moment, and I went through, I think, about five major points of astrology. And what I'd like to do is take them one at a time, although maybe you have observed things that cross over and interrelate, since all the planets are all talking to each other all the time. It's just a question of what pathway the conversation takes, or the tone of the conversation, and can both sides hear one another? And to participate, this is what you do is you press star 2 to raise your hand, and then I will select you. I'm looking at a smaller roster than people actually registered and paid, but there's enough people to keep the conversation going. Some of the names I recognize, and I will just remind you that I'm not looking for any expertise here. There's no need for that whatsoever. This is purely about being able to look out at life, look within, and to feel how you are, how you are being shaped by the moment, and what influence you feel you have to influence the environment around you and influence the flow of events. And I think that being one of the main differences between an adult and a child is that adults have much more power to influence the flow of events directly rather than, for example, indirectly or through some form of manipulation. Adults actually have the ability to make decisions. Most of us have things like car keys, credit cards, and money to be able to solve problems. We have some sense of volition and some sense of what our prerogatives are. So I don't see any hands up. I want to talk for a minute about the Uranus-Eris conjunction that's been going on and that I have been watching slowly develop over the years, and we at Planet Waves have been watching it, I think, with some bewilderment because, until recently anyway, because this is, first of all, not anything that's happened before with Eris present or in our lifetimes, right? So the last time this happened was in 1927-1928. And because Eris is at its furthest point from the sun, Eris being one of those contemporary planets that really is all about now, it was discovered in, I think it was first sighted in 05, and then it was named in 06. Remember that, when Pluto was demoted and kind of a new era of astrology began? And interestingly, this didn't begin in the usual quiet fashion, like, for example, with the discovery of Chiron, largely going unnoticed. It got one mention in the New York Times, but astrologers picked it up and kind of organized around it, recognizing that a new era had begun. I'm not so certain that was the case when Eris was discovered and named. In some ways, it was, let's put it this way. There had already been quite a few planets beyond Pluto discovered by 2006. The first one was discovered in 1992. And so it wasn't really news in that it was not the first planet beyond Pluto. Had it been the first planet beyond Pluto and been of comparable size like it was and all that, I think there would have been more excitement. But one thing that I can tell you about the astrology quote-unquote community is that in many ways it tends to play rear guard. It does a lot of predicting. The purpose of astrology in the minds of many is to predict the future, but it's amazing the extent to which astrology tends to look backwards, to look at the past. And so I don't think that the moment was really seized when Eris was discovered, but some astrologers did take interest. And in the winter of 06 into 07, right after Eris was discovered and was delineated as a dwarf planet and then named by its discoverers, I wrote a little book about Eris called Facets and Fragments of Self. And I had enough information to know that Eris was describing something about the structure of the contemporary personality. How we kind of run our mental operating system at this time. And I picked up on that partly because Eris is in Aries, and it was in Aries for a long time and was going to be in Aries for a long time. I think it spends 121 years in Aries. That's longer than any conventional planet like Pluto or anything like that. Not quite as weird as Sedna, but it didn't get the attention that Sedna got. So first of all, we're in this era of new kinds of planets being discovered. And from the standpoint of astrology, the problem with new kinds of planets being discovered is that there's absolutely no commentary in the classical literature that provides guidance on this, and therefore many astrologers are kind of left in the dust in terms of putting this stuff to work for them. And it takes imagination, and I think it takes some courage, just a little bit of courage, and it also takes the willingness to look up from the books and to look out at the world, or to kind of peel yourself back from the internet and experience the world as it is right now, which is, of course, the theme of our class. And so I had this archetype, Eris, and it started to become obvious that there was something about the fragmentation of self-concept. And this seemed to work out pretty well. And by the way, where I got this from was a clue from the provisional name that was given to Eris. The provisional name was Xena, the warrior priestess. And I didn't follow the show. It seemed kind of kitsch. I don't really need to be entertained in quite that way, so I had never watched this program, and I started looking into it because it was kind of cool that they named it after this sort of war, you know, the provisional name, kind of a code name prior to the official submission of a name to the International Astronomical Union. Mike Brown, the discoverer, had a hassle with Sedna because he named it before he was kind of legally entitled to name it. So Sedna, I'm not even sure the name Sedna, which is in Taurus and has like a 10,400-year orbit, is actually officially called Sedna, or if that's just kind of a provisional designation, because there's some controversy. So after that, all subsequent discoveries that Brown and his team did were given these fake names like Santa Claus, or in this case, Xena. And that just seemed interesting. And I worked with a friend putting the pieces together. And my one friend Paloma said, oh, if they're naming this after Xena, and look at this, look at the way the plot of this show is structured. The plot of this show is structured so that there's no continuity. Xena could be in Bethlehem one day, and then she could be in the future for the next episode, and then she could be in contemporary United States for the next episode. The show had what a literary scholar might call a postmodern structure. It violated the rules of linearity. So then it took about 10 years for me to figure out what half of my career, what was going on with this. And I didn't start to get the picture until I started working with the McLuhan family a couple of years ago. Now, Marshall McLuhan was something of a childhood hero of mine. My dad, as you may know, is a communications professor. And so I was kind of getting communication lectures when I was three. I was basically in grad school at 3 years old. And the talk of media theory was common household talk. And so McLuhan was something of a hero of mine. Then I met his grandson, then his son, and Andrew, Marshall's grandson, and I started. We set out with the project of trying to figure out what the internet was from a standpoint of McLuhan's approach. And McLuhan's approach is that new media creates structural effects that completely change the mind. The easiest one to see is the telegraph. This is from the early 1800s. This concept of telegraph is starting to come. At some point, they start sending telegraph messages from, you know, for example, Buckingham Palace to the White House. And what happens with that is that they collapsed space and time. Normally, you'd have to write a letter, and then somebody would have to take a horse and buggy and go to the dock and get on a boat and then sit on the boat for a week to 3 weeks while the boat sailed across the ocean, get on another horse and buggy and go to the White House, get let in and knock on the president's door and hand him the letter. Now, suddenly, Buckingham and the White House were connected at the speed of light. So this is an example of the content of the message being irrelevant and the structure of the media being the most important thing that shapes consciousness. This is what is meant by the medium is the message. This is why people who analyze media from this standpoint can say that content is irrelevant to this particular analysis, because what's changing is our concept of the universe, our concept of self, our concept of space and time is being completely altered as these new things happen. And suddenly, we all find ourselves in the midst of one of the biggest communication revolutions of all time, which is the Internet. The Internet is taking like the last 20 major developments and summarizing them in one. For this class, we have depended on telephone, some form of radio, some form of television, some form of print, all kinds of little telegraph devices, and it didn't occur to me to connect the Internet to Eris until about 2 weeks ago, when I was in like my 40th discussion with Andrew about the impact of the Internet, and he said, this is, it is stripping people of their bodies. And then I got it. Now, the effect of electronic media has long been known to have a kind of a disembodying effect. The thing is that usually you don't go there 100 times a day. You might turn on the radio, you might turn on the TV, and the impact is not as intense. But when you are constantly projecting yourself into this thing all the time, and then suddenly the haze has completely subsumed our lives, where every last thing we do has this kind of discarnate quality, where you can't buy something in a local shop and not have your card swiped and not be accessing the entire communications network or some bank with its headquarters in Delaware and its server in Michigan. This is wildly disorienting. And so when I looked at this cycle, it became really clear after a few discoveries that when Uranus conjunct Eris happened first in 2728, three things were happening. The first radio station was licensed. The first TV broadcast happened. That was a little picture of Felix the Cat sent. And the transistor, which became the Internet, was patented. Then suddenly it made much more sense what it means to have the Uranus-Eris conjunction happening here at this kind of peak moment in digital history, where every invention has caught up with us all at once. And we've basically been shorn of our bodies. And it's extremely disorienting. And so if you're wondering what one source of all this complete instability and chaos is, it has to do with people not having any of their previous references about who they are. So as you may know, the first of three close together iterations of Uranus-Eris happened on June 9th. That was already 9 days ago. And there's going to be two more, I think, one in September and one in March. And so this is a kind of a watershed moment. We're entering a new era with this. And it is rare that anyone gets to know that we're actually doing this, because typically people are either A, not following astrology, or B, the astrology itself is not cognizant of this fact. In all of this time I've been writing and broadcasting on Uranus-Eris conjunction, I have yet to see one single other article by an astrologer talking about this. That is amazing. Time magazine estimated that there were 5,000 practicing astrologers in the United States, I think, in the 1990s. Probably now with the Internet, there's got to be 2 to 4 times that number of practicing astrologers. That's not a compliment. And I have not seen one shred of writing, other than among Planet Waves editors, about what this is about. That tells you something. It tells you something about the extent to which astrology is looking over its shoulder and not where it stands, not where we are going. So first of all, we have this experience that we're in of being shorn of body. Body is a potent form of identity. And so without the ability to identify with the body, there's a corresponding loss of identity. What I recently remembered also is when there is an identity crisis, violence increases because violence is used by many people as a means of finding their identity. And so if we're wondering why, assuming that there are not death squads operating in the United States, and by the way, the false flag theory of all these shootings, if we think of these shootings as being quote-unquote false flag, not really done by Adam Lanza, not really being done by the weirdo from Colorado, not really being done by Omar Mateen. The only other possibility is that there's death squads operating. I'm willing to entertain that possibility, but for now, let's consider the possibility that these incidents are actually done by messed up, disaffected youth. The thing about this is that it is very likely to be the seeking of identity through violence. Then, because everyone's hungering for identity, we tune in with an almost obsessive obsessive force to hear more and more and more about this stuff, but it's not satisfying. It's like looking at pictures of food rather than actually eating food. So a few things are going on here, one of which is the moorings that kept us focused on who we thought we were previously are basically gone. There remain some people who seek their knowledge from books, and they are the ones who are the most likely to have a strong self-concept because the self-concept is the product of books. It's a bit complicated to explain how this works in the brain, but it wasn't until the alphabet that there was sufficient power to separate people from their background. So in tribal cultures, we see that people are much more closely connected. Pre-literate tribal cultures, they're much more closely connected to their community. In places where there is literacy, people are separated from their community and take on a kind of a every man for himself army of one type of approach to life. And to some extent, that is all of us here. So this is going on, and we get this reminder that we're in a big moment. Arguably, every bit as big as when the transistor was patented and the first radio station was licensed and the first TV broadcast happened. Incredibly, all around the same time, all in the very first moments of Uranus in Eris in Aries and the Uranus-Eris conjunction in Aries that happens in 2728. I mean, to me, this is one of the most astounding synchronicities I've ever seen in astrology, particularly with delineating a new planet, which is something of a passion of mine. And to be able to have a series of historical events and images that are concentrated in one time frame and that take us to now. So what this calls for actually is an understanding of psychology and it's like in its many forms, related to our involvement with media. We tend to never think of this. That's because the purveyors of media don't have any interest in explaining this to us. They just want us to buy the next cool phone. There's never some analysis of what the phone is doing to people's minds. There's some scant analysis of what the microwave environment is doing to people's bodies. And to some extent, for example, your ability to sleep or concentrate when you're constantly being bathed by cell tower broadcasts coming in from every single direction and then several microwave devices right in the room that you're in. But the identity scrambling factor of the internet has not been contemplated, nor has the impact that that is having. McLuhan said that the purveyors of media no more care what their inventions do to us than a fighter pilot cares about how people feel on the ground after they drop their bombs. He described, for example, Apple dropping the iPhone on us as being the equivalent of a bombing run by Apple, not the delivery of some beautiful new little baby Jesus in the form of the iPhone, but rather the equivalent of a bombing sortie. And we're getting bombed, and it's almost as if we're not even asking where the bombs are coming from. We just dial away on our phones. And I'm not against these tools. Obviously, I spend my whole life in them. But what I'm advocating is that we understand what they have done to us. And so if you choose to raise your hand by pressing star 2, I'm curious your thoughts about what the digital environment has done to you. Now, I want to move on to a closely related topic, which is the Mars Station Direct, which is happening. Now, it is pretty amazing that at the moment of the Uranus-Eris conjunction in Aries, Mars, the planet associated with Aries, is in Scorpio, first of all, the other sign that it rules. Mars has two what are called houses, Aries, its day house, and Scorpio, its night house. And not only is Mars in one of its other places that it's associated with, but it's in an aspect to Uranus Eris. It's making a 150-degree aspect. It is talking. Mars and the Uranus Eris conjunction are in an ongoing, extended, rare dialogue because Mars does not station direct that often. This is an event that happens once every 2 years. And it's happening in Scorpio now, and it's happening in aspect to Uranus Eris. This is an aspect of give and take. Now, it's an aspect of adjustment. What is being adjusted? Mars in Scorpio is very much about the body. It's about the flesh and blood, hormones, birth and death, feelings, level of physical consciousness. Scorpio is one of the most important signs because it handles all of these matters that are so integral to life, and yet they are swept under the rug. So you might think that's the nature of Scorpio, is things that are the most important that are then cloaked in the most denial. They're swept under the rug the most dependably, sex, death, money, to give three examples. Matters of power, matters of persuasion, matters of the subtlest level of the body, for example, the way that endocrines run. And by the way, it's worth mentioning that we live in an environment that includes a massive assault on our endocrine systems through, for example, plastic and through toxins like PCBs and dioxin. And so there is, at the same time as there is this kind of electronic strangulation of consciousness and identity, at the same time there is a hormonal level strangulation of identity and of consciousness. And if you are wondering why all of a sudden it seems like transsexuality is the big thing, this is an example of that. It seems to be the only conversation that's happening in the sex education field or in sex politically is to some small extent being gay. Allegedly lesbian, gay, or bisexual, but notice that no one talks about bisexuality. Notice how that is skipped over. Lesbian is now normal. Gay is now normal. Hetero is now normal. Trans is being accepted if there are protests outside of McDonald's. Bisexuality is being skipped over. And I think that is so interesting as to verge on hilarious. But the trans part, the movement part, I think is a function of A, the wild disorientation of identity that has been inflicted on us by digital consciousness, and then second, the assault on the endocrine system by dioxin, by PCBs, by DDT, and particularly by all the phthalates in plastic, all the plasticizers that are that have the same kind of gender bending effect that all of the other organochlorine chemicals have. So There is, you might say, an identity crisis being spurred by the digital sphere with Uranus conjunct Eris in Aries. And then at the same time, there is a hormonal level of searching and seeking and making sense of things and trying to find oneself and finding that there's not much self to find unless you go down a few layers, associated with Mars stationing direct. Now, the thing with this Mars station is that it is never going to happen again like this. It's never going to line up with, for example, with the Uranus-Eris conjunction. What we have now is an utterly unique moment. You might have to move the charts around for millions of years to find this pattern again. So for all practical purposes, on the scale of human civilization, we are experiencing a one-of-a-kind event. And what makes it particularly exciting is that it's a one-of-a-kind event that includes slow-moving outer planets. At the same time, it moves something that involves something that's usually a fast-moving inner planet, Mars, close to us. And so there is some meeting between the most intimate body level, hormone level of reality, and the most broad sweeping cultural change, Uranus conjunct Eris. All right, now, assuming that any of that is personally relatable, I would love to hear from you. I really can't just go on lecturing for 3 hours like this. So if you would like to participate or are feeling willing or have something to add, a thought, a question, the first person will get the ball rolling. That's always what happens. Please press star 2 to raise your hand. I'm going to take a look at the Q&A portion of this and see if anyone has written in. See all questions. All right, let's take some of these. And notice that it's easier, seems, to type in your question rather than to participate vocally in real time off script. I would point out that this is a profound effect of the internet, which is to destabilize people from being in the present moment and actually thinking on your feet in real time. All right, we've got some hands up. Let's take a call from longtime friend of Planet Waves and one of my favorite artists ever, Charlie LeMay. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Eric. How's it going?
Excellent.
You know, I just want to add, for some reason, and I'm not sure, you know, why, but ever since the cell phones, you know, began, you know, way back, I have just had a knowing that I'm not supposed to have one. And the real oddity here is that my son went on to, you know, to work at Apple, and he's in human interface, and, you know, he's partly responsible for the iPhone. Love for me to have one, but I just you know, no, I'm not supposed to. So I'm not sure why that is, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're not you spend a lot of time in the digital realm. I mean, for those who don't know Charlie's work, you do old fashioned film photography in darkroom, and then these astounding digital images that are kind of these montages, and this whole kind of dream world has arisen from your work. I think I live with a lot of your work around me, so I get to kind of peer into your dream body quite a bit. And so you're not a Luddite. You're quite adept at this digital realm. Now, the thing is that this may be helping you in some way, and you may also just kind of be an experimental subject in some way, right? One of the things about media is that it will, like, for example, when literacy comes to a society, it will affect the whole society, including illiterate people.
Mm-hmm.
So you might want to account for some of the impact of the phone just as a cultural force, right? Just as a thing that, you know, influences your students, influences the language that you use with them, and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, the phone has really changed everything in the classroom. It's become instinctual behavior to check your phone.
Yep.
And, you know, as a teacher, I don't want to be responsible for the students' phones. You know, if I take possession of them, you know, then suddenly I become responsible. So I let them have them, and I just remind them to put them away when they take them out. But people, you know, we lost our dark room this year because we're moving. But what happened, you know, last year was I started to get all these rectangular fogging of photo paper in the dark room because they were using their phones without thinking in the dark room.
Oh, really? You mean the microwaves were exposing the paper?
The film, the phones, the light of the phones was exposing the paper.
Ah.
So they would answer their phones like they're in, you know, every so many minutes, you know, almost like having a, their cigarette break or whatever. And now they're doing this no matter where they are, and they're not conscious of it. It's a totally unconscious thing.
Yeah. You know, my dad teaches, so, and he makes all the students agree. It's right on the syllabus. If you use your phone in class, you either have to drop the class or or you're failed. I think that you can withdraw up to the withdrawal deadline, or you, which is penalty. You know, you lose your tuition.
Yeah.
If you withdraw, like in week five, you lose your tuition.
Yeah.
He gives him the option to withdraw, and he said that once he lays that law down, he only ever had to make a student withdraw one time.
Yeah.
Once, but he's very strict about this.
Right.
He's
but
an
you know,
he's an Aquarius, so.
No, that's
he's not afraid to be a dick if he needs to be one.
Yeah, but that's the old school way of teaching. I think the new way is to be embedded in the student, in the same place your students are. So you have to be, by example, you know, passionate about what you want them to be doing. And that gets infectious, and then they follow you. You can't be dictating and having decorum and all those other things. I just find that's counterproductive to a creative learning environment. And I get amazing results from the way I do it. So the phone just, you know, I see it more as there's a student spring coming. the way it worked, you know, the Arab Spring doesn't happen without cell phones, right? Without smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a situation where education is masking, you know, massive youth unemployment because people believe they're going to get a degree that will guarantee them a high-paying job. But the data on the other end shows very few high-paying jobs are being created. At some point in the future, this is going to hit the fan. People will stop believing, and they'll be in debt over their head. I don't know what will give, you know, but something's going to have to give. And because they're all connected in the instant, it's going to be different than it's ever been before.
Yeah, we're definitely in a moment where we're in some kind of perfect storm. I don't know quite what it is. And what's so interesting is that it seems to me the most dependable ways to make a living in our current environment are old ones, like being a butcher or candle maker.
Hmm.
You know, professions that existed, you know, that were commonplace a century ago and to some extent existed 50 years ago, but did still exist 1,000 years ago. There were people who made candles and cheese and meat 1,000 years ago. It seems like those are the most dependable jobs to make an actual living.
Yeah. The big thing I've noticed about this particular time is that the times like this, you know, our conversation will appear to last a lot longer. In other words, time seems to slow down in the moment, but then on the longer scale, it seems to be shortening. So I'm having that sort of two-way contradictory experience of time, and I don't know if that's related to what's going on, you know, because for me, anyways, the Eris and Uranus conjunction happens, conjunct my natal Mercury in the seventh house, and then that's between a trine exactly in the middle where natal Uranus is in Cancer in the ninth, conjunct the midheaven, and Venus and Jupiter are in a conjunction in fifth house Aquarius. So it's kind of a big spot for me.
I think time is an important issue here because it does seem like we're being whipped through the decades right now.
Yeah.
What happened a week ago seems like it's so far in the past.
Yeah.
Yet so much happens in a week.
Right.
You know, today's Saturday, the alleged shooting in Orlando, it'll be 1 week at 2:00 Sunday morning.
Right.
Right. This, how long, it seems like much longer ago, doesn't it? It seems like we've had every possible discussion we could have in the course
of
time.
Yeah, except that my feeling is it feels like it only just happened. You know, like, I know what you're saying. That space
you don't have an iPhone.
Seems stretched out. What's that?
You don't have an iPhone. So I may be
No, that's right. I don't. But I mean, I think, like, something simple like garbage pickup day seems to happen every 3 days instead of every seven.
Yeah, I get it. Well, it's like the monthly horoscope seems like it's due once a week.
Yeah.
Like, I turn around again and the monthly horoscope's due.
Yeah,
I've already written four weekly horoscopes, but the monthly one is really... It's due again? It's already getting near the 20th?
Yeah, but then when you're writing it, doesn't it seem like, oh, wow, it's only 2 o'clock? You know, that's what I mean. Like, in the moment, it seems to be stretching out. But, you know, the weeks themselves are, you know, they seem to be shorter. You know, like, the time between cyclical events seems to be shortening.
Well, I mean, time is a concept. I mean,
the
concept of linear time that we're taught, we have a hard time seeing it that way, but it is a concept of time. It's not it's not the definitive version of time. I mean,
it's made up.
Proved it. It's made up, and it does not withstand experimentation. You know, time moves more slowly when you are in motion. That is to say, an atomic clock moves more slowly on an airplane or a train. Not even you don't even need an airplane or a rocket ship. Okay, so I've got a whole bunch of hands raised, Charlie. I'm going to move on, but if you want to jump back in, and thanks for being first. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good morning, Len.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Excellent. This is Len Wallach, Planet Waves writer, an old friend. And what is on your mind, Len?
Well, first off, I did not see the whole video ahead of time. I saw about 21 minutes before it was time
to
call in.
Yeah, you've been spoon-fed this stuff for like 2 years.
What's that?
You already know it.
But I wanted to, do the Nessus thing and take responsibility for not having seen the whole video ahead of time. Interesting thing is what I did see the video was organized in a little different way than your opening statement here today, what you were talking about here today was more about the content, and whereas the video was trying to kind of break things down and give it an idea of how we're going to be approaching this. There's a lot of complexity going on here. So one of the things I wanted to try to get an idea of is there a single organizing principle of all things that are being discussed today that you would want us listeners to focus on? Because, I have all these notes just from your opening statement, and I'm trying to get a single organizing principle having seen only 21 minutes of the video.
Well, in the astrology, I think that the most standout thing is this Mars station direct quincunx Uranus Eris series.
Okay.
So I'm looking at that as a kind of a flow between Scorpio and Aries of two different concepts of what a person is, two different realities of what a person, how we define what a person is. You might say that the activity in Aries is more about self-concept And the activity in Scorpio, Mars, stationing direct, is a more tangible, grounded experience of what you are and how you feel.
Okay.
So I think it might be a kind of a discussion between self-concept and self.
Okay.
And self-concept being this thing that's being highly shaped by the digital environment, and self being something that's accessible more through feelings, let's say engaging existential reality, relationships, sex, death, hormones, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
All that Scorpio stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you have the quincunx aspect, which you have described in some of the things you've written this week, as halfway between the easy flow of a triumph and the more problematic situation of an opposition. And that's often been described as kind of an adjustment thing. Would the word adjustment fit with what you're getting at on the quincunx between?
Yeah, and I like that delineation more and more as time goes on. But I think by adjustment, I think of give and take on either side.
Mm-hmm.
Adjustment means that you can actually make changes. Adjustment means you can adjust things. And just the word just, what is the etymology of that? Right, because Crowley changes the name of his card from justice to adjustment, right?
I think it's reconciliation. Reconciliation, I would say.
Yeah, and I would say that's what that aspect feels like to me. Some reconciliation between this onslaught in the digital realm and how it is completely mangling what we think we are, and our relationship to the physical body and physical level, versus some direct experience of that physical level coming through Mars and Scorpio. Assertion.
Okay.
Of that, you know, it seems like Mars does more of the doing, and Uranus Eris is kind of doing to us, whereas Mars wants to actually take control and do something. So the doing is taking place in Scorpio, remember when this conversation began, I was looking at the relationship between Sagittarius and Scorpio, and taking the approach of looking through the cover-up of organized belief systems of the physical level of reality. For example, why every major world religion that's typically practiced has to suppress sex and women. Just because it seems to be like that's what you do. You open up a fast food place, you grind up cows and serve them. You open up a religion, you grind up women and you dehumanize them, and you claim that you're making the world a more moral place by doing this.
Well, that's kind of going on. That's a good subject too. This is what I mean. Things are really expanding rapidly here in the discussion. But I want to step back a second here on with this, having gotten from you what you think the focus is, which is this quincunx between Mars stationing direct and the Uranus Eris conjunction, and go back to what you mentioned about the thing about transsexuality, bisexuality, and just in general the big changes that have taken place in terms of sexuality in just a generation or two, and then you're correlating that with exposures to plastics and other things that influence the endocrine system, and I think that's very cogent. And I would like to take it one step further and say that it represents life itself adjusting to a new environment. In other words, this is a form of evolution. So what we're witnessing when we're seeing an entirely different experience on the part of young people today compared to when Uranus and Pluto were conjoined in the 60s as regards to sexuality, and I think it can be interpreted as people being born more recently, confronting an environment, their bodies confronting an environment with insults to the endocrine system and among other things, and then an attempt, whether conscious or otherwise, to adapt to that environment. In other words, a form of evolution going on. And that is, that's something that came up for me. And then there's also the question of a chicken and egg. You mentioned about the collapse of space and time with the advent of the telegraph. And, of course, the unification of space and time, kind of a reductionist approach, was key to Albert Einstein's relativity theories. He unified matter and energy equals mc squared. We now, pretty much everybody accepts that matter and energy are the same thing, they're not separate. And space and time, that was another unification he made. And so when you brought that up about the telegraph, which had its advent in the 19th century, and then in the early 20th century came relativity, it brought up to me, okay, here we have a kind of a chicken and egg thing. Was Einstein, in his imaginative, mind experiments that he used to come up with these theories, was he basically picking up on the environment and practicing an evolutionary adjustment, an adaptation when he came up. So this is why I asked for the focusing thing and then two things that jumped out for me is you have what appears to be a process of evolution, but there's a question about, a chicken and egg question that's going on here. And so what I'm trying to do here is a little bit of a Chiron thing is, because there's so many things that, and I don't mean to ignore the things that Charlie LeMay was just talking about, because that was all very cogent too. But I'm just trying to bring a little focus here. There appears to be an evolutionary theme here, and there also appears to be a question of a chicken and egg question.
Yeah, with perception and what is perceived, there's often that, and also notably, right on the heels of relativity comes quantum, and so we go very quickly from space and time collapsing to everything happening simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's absolutely the quantum. That's the quantum thing, and everything is a potential, and therefore nothing is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And these developments.
That idea goes way back in spirituality, long before science.
Sure. Well, it goes back to right-brain societies that are able to think in non-linear ways. It's
right,
only
absolutely.
Because we are so left-brained and to be able to put the letters in order that we're reading, we have to develop the left-brain function highly to be able to have there be one good guess of what that word means. Right?
Mm-hmm.
People who are more right-brained, like artists and poets,
mm-hmm.
don't need just one strict linear definition of things.
Absolutely.
So what happened was that all this electronic, first of all, electronic instruments and theories of energy thrust us into this right brain environment,
mm-hmm.
Which we were not adept at, which then disoriented many people on the thing they were adept at, which was some tangibility, some concrete
mm-hmm.
meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So if it seems like everything is meaningless right now, that's partly why. It's because we're in this kind of hemispheric chaos, and the kind of crazy thing is fewer and fewer people will remember when things made sense in a certain way. When an editorial could say this makes no sense. Now you're starting to see, for example, the Democrats finally stood up to the Republicans on the issue of gun control this week. And it's as if it took like 50 mass shootings for anyone to get sufficiently sobered to drag, for any Democrat to drag himself down the aisle to the podium, climb up the podium and stand there propping himself up and say anything and attempt to make sense. And I think there are viewpoints that are thriving on the ability, the complete lack of ability of people to make sense. The only way you could say the way to make a club where gangs go safer is to allow guns in is that people are not making any sense at all within their own minds. Right? The only way you could say we believe in the First Amendment in support of liberty and we want to make it as easy as possible for our enemies to get weapons to shoot us. That doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
But the way that it does make sense is that if the concept of reason is applied to the gun control debate, that will catch on. So what the gun advocates are doing is they're making sure that the discussion stays as far away from logic, rationality, and reason as possible, because reason is the enemy of gun nuts, not gun control.
Oh, yeah. Sort of like, don't confuse me with facts kind of thing.
Yeah, and don't confuse me with actually needing to think about this.
That's right.
And so it plays into, I don't want to think about it. I just want to feel good. And in our disoriented state, we think violence feels good. So we might be asking ourselves how we're finding ourselves if we're not going out and killing people or watching video games all day. Or playing video games.
Well, the violence is a defining thing. I found that very interesting. Number one, there's a book in the 20th century, in a movie called Fight Club. And one of the themes of that book and movie is the appeal of the Fight Club, of being in the Fight Club of for one of the characters, the initiate character, is learning about himself, and so that's something that it's a theme that has come up in in the media in the 20th century, and then it also, though, however, it does take me back to the whole Vietnam era, and I was active in the anti-war movement as a young man. And I found it very offensive for people to say, well, you've got to be in the army and be in the war, in a war, in order to be a man. And I thought that was very offensive. I think there was an essay written at one time by somebody who was a member of Nixon's administration, and he said, well, it's kind of like he used an example of John Muir rejoicing and experiencing an earthquake and making an equivalent with war, and I found that to be very offensive, because earthquakes happen as a result of natural processes, and wars are not a result of natural processes. They're a manipulative socioeconomic thing that they become, and even before that, they also were basically people who were stealing stuff from people who were the truly productive ones. But I would like to kind of offer here a focus based upon what you say is the focus of the whole astrology, and that is the Mars station quincunx Uranus Eros. That having to do with adjustment, and that bringing up the idea that, and once again, having only seen 21 minutes of video, but having, I think, as you pointed out, gotten the gist of it, that what we're talking about here as a focusing, unifying thing is that what we're talking about is evolution, and of course that goes back to Pluto in the Pluto Uranus square. Pluto had the evolutionary and Uranus the revolutionary. So I'd just like to kind of offer kind of a you know something to kind of possibly bring some focus to without neglecting or underrating other subject matter here. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Excellent. Good. Glenn, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So let's see. Next call is from Jefferson City, Missouri. Welcome. That'll be you.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your name? What's on your mind?
Oh, my name is Marianne, and I'll try and sound coherent here. I think that this time is kind of exciting. I am an activist of sorts. I won't go into details, but I find that the internet represents a way of really communicating some really hard ideas to people that they need to hear about, related to environmental issues and the treatment of animals. And so I kind of would just like to explore ways of communicating over the environment, using the environment to communicate these things to people, especially considering there's so much out there that is anti-productive, anti-environment. You know, there's anti-everything. You know, big business, pimping, you know, all kinds of things that are just really counter to what we should be doing in light of the fact that, you know, our planet is sick. So anyway, I think it's kind of exciting, and I just kind of wanted to say that, you know, I think it represents kind of a window of opportunity to affect change. It used to be if you wanted to spread a message, it was much harder. You know, you had to appeal to the media to get a story done. And that took, you know, a ton of work. But, you know, as you know, now a person with, you know, just a few thousand dollars worth of video equipment can produce what they want, you know, and put it on a YouTube channel.
So let's talk about the result. Let's talk about the results, though. Right.
Okay.
You know, I see the potential. Obviously, I experiment every day with it. And I'm from the print era. You know, I came of age in the print era. So I've experienced the impact of print and the impact of internet. What,
right.
When you talk about change, what, besides people having read the thing, what change have you seen?
Animal rights movement has had an effect on, for example, cage-free eggs, let's take that as an example, has done, produced material on the reality of the lives of chickens in egg farms. Okay, mm-hmm. That gets out on the internet. People see this video, okay? Now, more and more grocery stores, restaurants, et cetera, are pledging that they will not buy eggs from suppliers that use battery cages, okay? So so that, you know, that's one example. I wish there were more. I wish there were more environmental examples that I could come up with, you know, right now. But it seems to be that whatever, you know, as you mentioned, it has to, whatever message is put out there, it has to be very concise and, you know, just, you know, nobody has an attention span. You know, nobody's going to look at read a report that's 5 pages long. It's got to be like, you know, 2 pictures or 20 seconds of video, short message, boom.
That's what you're up against.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
And that's a product of the internet. That is not a product of even of TV or of radio.
Oh, right.
That 20
yeah.
second thing,
I,
that shrink it I down agree. Thing is, right, and the attention span. So now, regardless of, you know, our opinion of the internet, we're all having to work in an environment of reduced attention spans. But I think that it's gone to the level of not caring at all because of the disembodiment effect. Now, what do you mean by, what do I mean by care? Well, I think I mean care is enough to do something with your body. Now, it's encouraging that more places are serving cage-free eggs. Maybe that will catch on. I mean, it would be good to see the numbers on that. I mean, I know that most of the restaurants in my neighborhood do that, but there's bazillions of chickens around here. The streets are just overrun with chickens. They're laying eggs all the time. So I can't imagine going to Manhattan and getting cage-free eggs most any place.
Right. Well, you know, also Manhattan is, you know, I find it shocking that in a sophisticated city like New York that there are, for example, so many pet stores that sell puppy mill sourced dogs. There are, fur stores all over the place. Unenlightened situation, but
right.
Well, anyway, mm-hmm.
We have a lot of rescues. I'm suggesting that the physical environment has more impact. In other words, we have the cage-free eggs here because we can get them, and there's a little different ethic around animals. I mean, you know, you'll sometimes see people. Nearly every dog I meet is a rescue. Let's put it that way. Why? Because I meet every dog. I've got this little dog ministry going on. So I meet all the dogs. I hear their story. And 80% at least are rescues here rather than pet store dogs. And we're only 2 hours north of Manhattan. So, you know, a lot can change in 2 hours. You go
well,
2 hours
right.
outside
well,
of Paris.
Well, that's right.
Not in Paris.
Right. That's your neighborhood. But, you know, but I guess how do you get people to care to care about the physical planet? You know, I mean, what does it take? What do you have to show people? You know, to give a shit. You know.
Yeah, it may be about having the shit to give, and this is
right.
I think a crucial question for anyone attempting to do anything that depends upon, for example, ethics. Because my concern with the internet is it's just more internet. it has a way of flattening out the importance of everything. I mean, I noticed this the first time way back in the day when there were hardly any astrology websites, and someone published a list of articles by the great astrologers, and I was on the list, and so was Rob Hand. I'm thinking, wow, I've been doing this for 2 years, and Rob Hand's been doing it for 25 years, and we're on the same list. So it has a way of flattening things out. And, you know, TV has that also. There's a much stronger gatekeeper effect with TV. How do you get on TV? But I think in some ways it's all the same. There's this flattening out. Now, when you look at what got a result in the past, the book Silent Spring got a result in a more literate era when you could read something and be moved by it. You know, I can hardly get anyone to read Silent Spring, nor do I know anyone who has read it. Now, you know, maybe there's some older folks who read it back in the day. In all my ranting and raving years talking about Silent Spring, starting with the anniversary, I got into one conversation with a person familiar with the book. And it's
wow.
Like, well, how did you... There's no way to convey the information in Silent Spring. I mean, I can sum the book up in two sentences, but it does not have the impact of sitting there and reading the story of the soil system and her personal witness. And that book moved Kennedy to ban DDT, to organize that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, and so I wrote an article on the history of PCBs that made the cover of Sierra magazine in the summer of 1994, an incredible 22 years ago. Well, Waxman, Congressman Waxman from California, told Sierra they would call for congressional hearings. Now, some other news event broke that summer, and the congressional hearings never happened. But even to have a congressman say that they would call for congressional hearings based on an article. But that article took me 2.5 years to research and write.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the cover of a major national environmental magazine, all in the very dawn of the Internet. Right? I was doing that work from 92 to 94. Much more impact. I don't feel like I could write anything now that has impact. I assume the impact I'm going to have on one person.
Uh-huh.
Sure. Come on. Look at my repertoire of articles. Look at the discoveries I've made as an astrologer, the incredible things I've come out with. Apart from individual people, I don't have anywhere near the recognition I should have given the gravity and the accuracy of the things I've written about. And that's not a reflection on me as much as it is a reflection on the environment. The environment doesn't seem to foster caring. So we who want people to care or have some interest in them caring have a huge question on our hands. What does caring now mean? As my dad says of his students, nothing is profound. Everything is just awesome. But nothing has actual depth.
Right, yeah.
So we have a big question on our hands here. You know, what does it take?
Right. How do we get people to care in this age?
Yeah, care.
You know,
action.
I'm sorry. Care and what?
To care and move on it. To move on it.
Right. Oh, right. Right. Yeah.
You know, what gets you off your ass and out into a situation where you can actually make a difference?
Right. Right. Well, you know, it's like. Right. Right. Well, it's you know, if people believe what they want to believe.
That was always true.
So, you know, whatever's easiest for them to accommodate in their lives is what they will tend to believe. But I don't know.
And it's easier
to
buy that cute puppy. It's easier to buy that cute puppy on Fifth Avenue.
Well, yeah, when you can
go through an adoption process.
Right. Exactly. You can just plunk down your credit card and it's done.
Right.
Yep.
Well, good food for thought here. I think we should move on to the next call.
Yeah.
Thank you for your contributions. Right. Please stay in touch.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Learning a lot here. Got a cell phone from, looks like from Florida, if that's you. Welcome.
Eric, is it me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
Hi. I'm blown away by everybody who's talked before me, so I'm going to just try to be as brief as possible, but I'm 64, and I've also been around a lot of print, worked in print, et cetera. And when I first noticed people getting absorbed in their cell phones, they weren't smartphones yet. They were just flip phones. Even then, I had one just for necessity, but I just found people's absorption in the phones and constant talking and everything just out in public kind of, I just prided myself in not needing that, not being addicted to that. And then over time, I ended up getting a smartphone, which, you know, the little computer you talk about we all carry around in our pockets, or many of us do. And I found, it's just been really hitting me lately, that it's crept up on me that the digital haze that you mentioned has really crept up on me. I used to be a very creative person, and I still have the creativity, but I find myself more and more receiving, just, you know, listening to entertaining things. The child in me wants to be entertained, and I love the adult too, and I love music, and I love, you know, comedy and all these different things. And I feel like I've allowed it to sort of flatten me. Like these things have become flattened, but I feel like my creative receptors, from which I used to pour out lots of paintings and I sang and I entertained people, have been kind of readjusted. And I want to find a way to adjust, to readjust and evolve back to at least where I was, if not more, contributing to the world around me rather than just receiving. And I find the internet a way to care. We have a neighborhood group, several neighborhood groups that I broke my knee a couple of months ago, and people came and helped me that never would have known I was here alone. And I've given stuff away to them, to people who needed a walker when I didn't need mine anymore. So there's some good stuff out there, and the people who do care find the internet just another medium to express themselves and meet and do things together. But I'm concerned more on my personal gut level stuff that's going on, and it's disturbing me, and I'm glad to have a place to admit it.
So what's one of those concerns?
The main one is I seem to have lost my spark to create. I have the talent, the ability, the desire, but the desire is not, it used to be just something I did normally, and it seems like I'm allowing my listening and watching videos and stuff and listening to music kind of engulf my own expression.
Yeah, what's an example of that? Like a direct, you know, a tangible example so we can feel that.
I used to go out with my guitar and sing. Sometimes I wrote songs, and mostly I sang other people's songs and stuff from the 30s and the 40s and music from around the world, and entertained friends and it's just kind of, I rarely pick up my guitar anymore, even just for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like my soul is ailing or something. I don't want to blame it on the internet, but I think the availability of it kind of become a drug for me, kind of numbing me.
Right. And that's a well-documented effect of all this electric media. Extend, cut off.
Exactly. I never thought I would be this kind of person. I mean, I don't feel a victim, but I want to know how I can push myself back out of it, you know, climb out of this hole that I feel I've allowed myself to fall into.
Yeah. Well, you might engage your creative tools and you might just, you know, however hard it is, pick yourself up and get out among people.
Yeah, I hope to do that soon. I still can't walk quite yet, but
I see.
I think that's, yeah, but being sort of lying down a lot for 3 months because I couldn't even sit up because I have back issues also. So when I broke my knee, I just had to lie down a lot. And so part of the way I got through it was to listen, you know, just let the time encapsulate so I could, till I could walk again. And still can't quite walk, but I brought the guitar to my bed and I was lying down trying to play it. It just didn't quite work that way, but it's encouraging just to be able to share that with people, with you and the people who have joined us today. And
Well, thanks for sharing and stay in touch.
Thank you.
And, you know, we're doing what we can at Planet Waves to provide a live environment in the internet and also an environment that is constantly fostering creativity and for you to engage those things that you feel make you human. I mean, if Planet Waves has one theme, it would be we're here to help you do what you need to do to feel more human and be more human. So, you know, stay tuned. We've always got something cooking.
You do, and you bring tears to my eyes. I really appreciate it, Eric.
All right. Good. Be well.
Thanks.
Bye for now. All right. Cell phone in Pennsylvania, the one and only who's got their hand raised. This is Eric. Hello.
Hi. This is Christina. So,
hi.
So,
Christina, that I've ever talked to before?
I emailed you about a week ago about an apprenticeship.
Ah, right.
Yes.
Good. All right.
So, okay. So a few things that, I mean, I raised my hand a while back, so now I've got tons of notes based on everything that everybody said before me. But, okay, so looking at, like, Pluto in Capricorn going in 2008, I've been thinking back on things that have happened at that time. And 2008 was the first, that was when I had my first Facebook account. And let's see, I'm 34 now. And I was at the time I was in architecture school and I was going through school kind of late. I was about 6 years older than everybody I was in school with, and I remember, like, the Facebook thing, I really didn't want to do it, but my mom sent me a request, and I ended up just doing it because I didn't want to deny my mom a friend's request. It's a kind of harsh thing to do. So I kind of found myself on this thing I didn't really want to be part of. And then my classmate, there was like a classmate in my studio who was, had sent me 2 friend requests and I had never spoken to this person. It was a male and, he never like seemed to show any interest in speaking to me and so I just ignored the first one, and then the second one, I was like, well, maybe I should just be a little, I don't know, maybe I should need to be sensitive about this person. Maybe he really wants to be my friend. And, so I remember I went to this person and said, yeah, I was like, hey, listen, you know, I don't want to take a friend request from somebody I am not actually friends with, but if you would like to become my friend, I'd be totally down to go get tea sometime, have a conversation, get to know you. And it was very awkward. I don't think he had any intention of being my friend, and it was kind of a big learning experience in some ways, like that it kind of redefines what it means to be a friend. It's just like a, almost like a collection of just, or a number. But I think that brought up a lot, that whole social media thing, like really, as far as destroying what it means to be a person in a body, you know, like that you would in some way conceive of yourself being friends with somebody that you've never really spoken to or that wouldn't even want to spend time with you in real life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very odd. And then the other thing was that I had to, you know, there's like, I had to be friends with a lot of people in my family. And it's just, it's weird. It's kind of like leveling, the intimacy playing field in ways that is not very comfortable, I'd say, because in a relating to somebody one-on-one, I would be kind of selecting what information I share with that person based on how comfortable I am with that person, like how much do I feel that person has an understanding of me, then I can possibly share deeper things that might be misunderstood by others. It was very odd because here I was on this internet forum where I thought, like, my concept was, oh, I can be free to kind of say what I think or share things that I think, but I didn't feel that way because it's like, oh, my whole family is watching, you know, so if I wanted to share something that was sexual, that would be awkward, you know, whereas...
Well, how about that? I do think that it's important to question that awkwardness.
Yeah.
Well, what's the big deal?
Well,
I mean, they've got to make you, right? They have the sex. You wouldn't exist. I want to go back to that.
Right, okay. So, but there are things like, I think it goes back to how much does somebody understand me? So if I'm sharing something, one of my favorite musicians, his name is Adam Green. He makes like really intense sexual music, and it can be really dark. And just to share that with just anybody, that person might come away with a strange understanding of who I am. But to share it with somebody who knows me is going to be different. So, because they can kind of put that in the context of who I am. I don't know. I guess on a level of idealism, it makes sense. Well, like, oh, sure, like, why not be 100% transparent with every single person? But the reality is that then you end up having, you know, hundreds of weird conversations with people that maybe aren't worth your time. The last caller brought up this issue of creativity, and something that I noticed was, I think in 2013 I did an experiment where I stopped using Facebook for a month. Or actually I just stopped using the internet altogether unless it was work related. And my creativity went through the roof. I was writing every day and it was just way more creative than it had been. And I think it was because I actually had some privacy. I wasn't like constantly wondering, oh, is this thing that I'm writing, is somebody going to like it? How many likes would it get? Or would nobody like it? You know, it just wasn't an issue anymore. And so I was just having actually the ability to engage with myself.
Yeah.
Well,
that you're the second vote for there's a creativity drain associated with the digital environment.
Yeah, or it's just tricky, I think. You know, if, and with the phones, too. Like, before there were cell phones and all this stuff, it was, like, if you wanted to call somebody, they had to be home. They had to be, like, available. They couldn't be, like, driving or talking to somebody else or whatever. Like, you, if you call somebody and you got them, they were probably available. But now it's like, a couple weekends ago, I went for a float, like an isolation tank float. And when I got out, I had like an angry text from my sister who was like, oh, you're not answering me, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh my God. Somebody, like, to have somebody be upset that they aren't hearing from you within like a 1 hour time span is crazy. But
right.
That's kind of how it is now.
Yeah. Well, and this is how the structure, not the content of the text, has shaped consciousness. So suddenly, no matter what the
right.
subject, we're expected to be available all the time. It used to be neurosurgeons. The first person I knew who had a digital device was a neurosurgeon named Stan Weinstein. And he was a brain surgeon. It made sense for him to have a digital pager in the 70s because he might have to be expected to perform neurosurgery on someone who might otherwise die. There is some rationality to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Neurosurgery. The first person
yeah.
I ever saw with a cell phone was an organizer for Communication Workers of America, local 1199, I think, down in the city. A big shot in the union, big shot in the big union, had what I called at the time a suit phone, because he could fit it in his suit pocket, because his wife was about to go into labor. Now, that makes somewhat less sense. You're in labor for a while. You could check in every couple of hours. You know, usually female humans don't hatch like puppies. It takes a while. But still, that was the first time I heard. Now everyone needs to be available for everything all the time. So there's a whole set of cultural expectations that have been imposed on us by devices. Or the use of them.
Yes, it's really – so that's – I think that's – if I didn't say this, it's a huge part of the creativity thing is because you kind of need some time to be creative. If you're constantly like, oh man, I have to check my email, I have to respond to 1,000 people, I have to, when do you have the time to even tap into that space?
I would argue that it's more than about time also. I think it's more about the way that self-concept is being structured. Memory is being structured, for example, in a way. Our ideas about time and progress are being structured.
Yeah.
We didn't always have, you know, the first computer I worked on, well, the first computer I worked on didn't even have a hard drive. It had no memory capacity except for the immediate article that I typeset. And
like
we had, it was a CompuGraphic MCS system. It was a typesetting system, not yet computer, but not yet digital output. It was still photo output. But the thing is, I think we only had like 3 disks. We didn't even archive our old copy. We'd rewrite over the disks because there were no disks. Floppy disks were a new thing. Remember those 5-inch floppy disks?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe not. Maybe some people work with them. Well, we only had like 2 or 3 of them. We had the boot up disks. They were very important. The boot up disks were like, had a kind of a spiritual aura around them, because without them, the whole computer wouldn't work. And then I believe there were one or two disks used for memory. And by disks, I'm talking about an amount of data that we today would think was laughable, like maybe half a megabyte per disk.
Uh-huh.
Like 450K per disk. So to suddenly have right on our desk a terabyte plus all the backup drives plus the cloud, the structuring of memory is huge. I mean, at a certain point,
right,
I realized the fastest way to find my own work was through Google, which at the beginning seemed ironic. If I was looking for something I had written, I would just look myself up in Google. You used to look through your file cabinet. Nobody else had access to it. Now,
yeah,
fits my public role. All this fits my public role perfectly, but not most people. Most people don't. They have no need, obligation, involvement with the wide public. But suddenly, you have everyone becoming a minor celebrity. Basically,
yeah.
And a publicist. I mean, people are constantly writing their own press releases. Well, this changes your idea of who you are. If you have, how many versions of profiles do most people have? They've got their LinkedIn version. They've got their Facebook version. Maybe they've got a little thing up on Twitter. Maybe they've written some personal ads. Well, this used to be the realm of only the famous and only publicists.
Yeah, okay, and that brings up something that I wanted to address with the person from Missouri brought up about, you guys were talking about activism and how do you get people to care, and she was bringing up the point that it was easier to spread a message, but my response is that it's harder to know what's true. A couple of months ago, I got sucked into a YouTube vortex of watching conspiracy theory videos, and there's this, stuff that's calling itself journalism, like, especially there's a channel, wearechange.org, and it's very, like, it's impossible to know what's true, or like, what I mean, the style of journalism is very, it's odd, and so, like, perhaps this person is coming from a place of really seeking the truth and wanting to empower people, or perhaps this person is, spreading disinformation, and
Hold that thought. The idea that this is impossible, it's impossible to tell whether this is true, is a reflection of our times.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, because I'm from print, and I work with literate, educated people from the print era,
mm-hmm.
right? Let's fact check this.
Yeah, well,
I don't have the belief that you can't tell whether something is true or not, because I believe that it's possible to fact check something.
Well, I suppose, but I guess, and maybe, perhaps you have these skills, like where you know where you can look to check for sure if something is true. But
come on, think about it.
But if I am coming from a place where I don't trust, traditional media outlets either. And then to know that, like, a lot of scientific studies are just totally skewed by who's funding them, and
just follow your own thoughts. That we have one difference in belief, it would seem, that I believe all of this can be analyzed and verified, because I believe in rationality. The digital response is you can't tell, and worse yet, it doesn't matter what's true and what's not. Who cares? If you like it, it's true. If you don't like it, it's not true.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's I know. I think that the truth, there is probably something that exists that is the truth, you know, like you could have a camera on the earth and just be like, okay, that's it. Like, that's what happened. But then there's also subjective reality, and then the people can choose what they want to believe. And, you know, like, you can just, it might be easier to spread a message to other activists, but harder to spread that message to anybody who isn't already in that loop or interested in, you know, tapping into that channel. You know, it's just as easy to spend all of your time, you know, it's just as easy for me to spend 24 hours or however long I'm awake tapping into astrology as it is for my mom to spend all day watching the Oprah Channel, or somebody else to spend all day watching football, or somebody, or just to scroll down forever on Facebook and be distracted by whatever's there.
Right. But you have to have your priorities, don't you? I mean,
right.
You need to have your priorities in order.
Yeah, I feel like that's a huge part of all this Neptune Saturn stuff these days, is like really kind of having an awareness of like, what am I doing with my brain? What am I doing with my attention? And like really kind of having to hold on.
Right. Hey, speaking of, I'm going to move on to another caller, then we'll take another,
okay.
We'll take a little break. I've got actually two more callers, and then we'll take a break. Thanks for calling in. All right. Waterford, Ontario. Hope this is who I think it is. Hello, you're on Planet Waves.
Hi, Eric. It's Mary Lynn. How are you?
Hi, Mary Lynn.
I'm just sitting back doing a lot of listening. And I did watch your video last night. For me, I feel a little bit differently, but somewhat the same. And I'll explain that. I'm very right hemisphere dominant, so I appreciate some of the comments that have been made about that. I think people like me are having a little bit easier time with this whole thing than people who have much more, I don't know, left brain, making sense of things all the time, don't necessarily go with the flow. But I also think some of the astrology that we've been talking about with the Uranus-Eris conjunction and Mars stationing direct, those things, the backdrop to all that for me, because I have a lot of planets in the mutable signs, is that we have these fluid boundaries in the background where there's no structure, and people are having a very hard time trying to make sense of what's happening. I hear it in every single call. And I think it's because in this background you have this whole mess happening in the mutable signs, and there's no safety net for this, so to speak.
What would a safety net be? What would be the kind of
just talking about all of the things that have happened in the last several years, even with, you know, all of our, you know, formal structures being, you know, dissolved, so to speak, by Pluto rampaging through Capricorn, whether it's the education system, whether it's government, whether it's the health system, whether it's, you know, religious systems, they're all, you know, there's this backlash of these things dissolving, and so there's all this chaos happening just in advance of this, and then you get this Uranus-Eris conjunction and Mars stationing direct, where it's a little more personal, and so, but the backdrop of that is that the previous foundations have sort of been disrupted, and then now you have this mutable Grand Cross where there's sort of all of this kind of fluid boundaries happening against this. It's like people don't know how to feel about this. They don't have a safety net of where they can put their feet down.
Right.
And so The other thing is that you, like others have mentioned, including yourself, this whole thing about Borsisi, people are grabbing to find out, okay, is what I'm hearing true? Or, you know, is what I thought all this time true? So they're even questioning what they know to be true. And when you're questioning who you are, what your institutions really are versus what they've presented themselves to be, and what you thought was true and what isn't true, and all of these things are, I think that's just a recipe for a total internal chaos, because we all look for some grounding, and I don't see that there is any right now. And
yeah.
I'll tell you something that's manifested in Canada here right now in Ontario, about 30 miles from where I live. My brother is a suicide counselor, and there's been a rampant epidemic of teen suicides about 35 miles from where I live. And there's been reports that it's related to bullying. There's been protests by students walking down to the Board of Education and to City Hall screaming for help. The media is reporting that there's been 5 since March, but there's actually been 7, so there's an underreporting that my brother doesn't understand. But they've also fielded hundreds of calls from kids that they've actually prevented from committing suicide. And so I think that's sort of a manifestation of so many of the things that people have been talking about, with this whole sort of not being able to figure out something that used to work, say for the person that played the guitar, or something that used to work for somebody who is more artistic or whatever. They don't have those places. They don't work anymore, or they don't seem to be able to find those places anymore. And I think, you know, there's definitely a creativity drain. I definitely feel that myself. I also am very intuitive, and I feel a huge intuitive drain too. Like, I used to be able to kind of see through things, and I'm finding that very difficult right now.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, yeah, there's a whole diversity of effects that we need to keep track of.
Exactly, and that's why I'm saying I think that, you know, I sort of appreciated your video, because it talked about a lot of different things, and it reminds me not to just stay focused on the one thing, because to me there's always, you know, this kind of veil that you have to lift. I have a 12th house Mercury, and I'm always sensitive to that veil. And the veil seems to be very heavy right now.
Yes. I think that, I'm not sure if you read my article about how the internet has imposed a kind of an astral plane onto the normal consciousness of the physical plane. We were all thinking, not all of us, but there was a lot of advertising that there was going to be some kind of an ascension associated with 2012. Remember all that? The ascension. And all the Pleiadian people were saying we were going to go into 5D and all that, remember?
Yep.
That going on? Well, actually, that was sort of right, only it was the internet. And the internet is almost, I always thought of it early on as being the first astral plane that we could colonize and come back to the same place. The thing with the astral plane is it's not necessarily easy to dream your way back to the same place you were yesterday.
No, it's
but
not.
What you get with the internet is a bizarre intersection of astral as an out-of-body dream-level consciousness coupled with the ability to document things in space and time, or at least in time.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of takes away the space aspect, actually. Actually, I'm working on a piece about this. It's going to take me a few weeks to finish. But you take away the space aspect, since there's non-locality. We all of us, 50 or so people right now, are in the same quote-unquote room, but we're all in different places. And we're all in different places at the same time. So now we have a kind of a non-locality meeting in the same time, in a conceptual place. So
yeah.
We're in a kind of a shared dream.
Mm-hmm.
The difference when you go half a layer up to the astral level is that the temporal order is also suspended. So
yeah.
That you can have a thought of someone, and then someone has the same thought 6 hours later, it
right.
still counts as being simultaneous, even though it's separated by so many hours and so many miles, because the rules of space and time are completely suspended on the astral layer level of consciousness. What we're doing with the internet is we're kind of morphing certain rules of the physical plane, like time, with certain characteristics of the astral level, non-locality or bilocality. So I'm manifesting in everyone's home, whether you're driving down, you know, I-90 or you're sitting in your art studio right now, right?
Yeah.
So how is that? Well, it's very disorienting, extremely disorienting. And I think burns up a lot of energy as people try to establish identity in this weird realm.
Yeah.
Now, what has further happened is that it is now everywhere. You used to just go to the internet. I think that the main difference that the phone added, and the chart for the iPhone is astounding. By the way, it's an Eris chart. It is a radically Eris chart. I'll do an article on it sometime soon. When Steve gets up on stage and he introduces the iPhone 1, thanks to Twitter or whatever, live blogging or Twitter, we know exactly what time he introduced the iPhone.
Cool.
So we have a chart for this, and it's a symbolic chart. There were smartphones in Asia before the iPhone came to the United States. But that was the threshold. That was the turning point. Made the internet everywhere. And so it became a thing on the go, just like you cannot have a gourmet meal on the go, because half of a gourmet meal is the ambiance. You don't just chug down a bottle of wine when you're sitting in a fine restaurant or your friend's house who made you a, you know, beef Wellington or whatever. You can't really reflect on anything on the go. And so the internet went from being this thing we would go to being a thing that basically swallowed everyone everywhere.
Yeah.
That is a huge change. And that is the phone.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that it's like a thief that you are complicit with, because it steals your time and it steals your mind in many ways, and yet you, it's like, I don't know, maybe even an addiction is that you can't disengage that easily either.
So the operative factor, I think, and this is especially true if we're taking it, if we're listening from McLuhan's standpoint, is that the conscious use of tools to some extent mitigates their damage.
Really?
That to take up the internet as an artist, as a digital artist, is very different than to take up the internet as your average Facebook user.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, for example, to produce a video, I have to do all the physical things that are necessary. So I'm getting ready to do a new video project called The Astrology Minute. Well, so me and my assistant were figuring out how to assemble a backdrop on Friday, right, on Thursday afternoon, and looking for metal chunks of metal tubing that we could assemble into a thing, and then I have to figure out the exposure and the lighting and the scripting and the costumes. We have to do all these physical level things on the construction level, on the level of making the content. So the tools are different in the hands of an artist than they are in the hands of a user. I'm in hog heaven with this digital technology, because to me it lends itself to almost infinite creative possibilities. And then I can do things like slap some paint on a canvas in all of 30 seconds. Oh, I need something. Someone's taking too long to get me this graphic. So all I do is squeeze some paint out on a dish, smush it around on the canvas, get the color right, snap a picture of it, and in 3 minutes, I've got a fresh piece of art. That is very different than sitting on Facebook and clicking like.
Yeah, yeah, because you have that layer of detachment through your process.
Well, or investment. I have a layer of investment.
But it provides that detachment from being totally sucked in by the media itself.
Yes. And I have to be conscious at every moment. I have to be aware of every step in the process, the architecture in the process. I go from the paint in the tube to the paint in the little white paint dish to the choosing the brush that I want, to mixing the color that I want, to taking the picture. I'm involved with every single step. It's very different. You know, it's completely.
Yeah.
And so I would encourage those who are threatened or feel the danger of digital technology to up your game and invest yourself more in it rather than less as a creator. And part of the difference is what parts of your brain you access and what elements of your consciousness you access, because as a creator, you're going to presume you're more in the role of control over your particular project.
Yep.
And you take a risk also. You take no risk liking something on Facebook.
Yeah.
Although I had someone once bitch me out for all the different things I had, like all the like celebrity pages I'd liked. And I guess somebody was looking through all the things that I liked, assuming that I was like actually voting for all of them, when a bunch of them, I'm liking them so I can comment on the page.
Oh my.
And they said, oh, I can't believe someone like you likes, name something. Like, I've been on the net for 20 years now doing this publicly, so I've pretty much heard it all. But there are things that I'm still like, the only appropriate response is to write back, you must be fucking kidding me. And I am not below doing that or above doing that. I will respond as gritty and as real as I feel like being, you know. I mean, the rule of Planet Waves is, on commenting, that you must respond to the editor. And you must respond to the editor's request for a phone call, or we will delete you.
Okay.
That's the law commenting at Planet Waves. Why is that? Well, why should a commenter be held to a lower standard than one of my reporters? If somebody's reporting on a story for me, they damn well better talk to me on the phone, or I'm going to delete them.
Yeah.
So it's the same with someone posting to the public that I'm responsible for the maintaining integrity around. And so that's what the terms of service say. If we request a phone call, you must comply or you're out. And I realize this is a somewhat hard line, but I'm looking to at least establish a baseline of integrity and veracity to avoid trolling behavior. We have relatively little. We have them occasionally, but it does happen. And to get a grip on that. And the way you get a grip on it is, all right, I'm a person. And we have another rule, which is that if you say something that is blatantly wrong or libelous, the correction is under your legal name. I don't care if you're Tennis Pro 304 201 when you're commenting.
Yeah.
If you commit libel in some way, and you want to get out of that, you want to make good on that, you take credit for what you said. So I don't know. I know it maybe sound like a little like my dad here saying, if you use your phone, use your phone, you get an F. I don't think it's quite that. There's a lot more room for negotiation in there. And I'm looking to raise the level of consciousness of what someone says when they type a comment in.
But therefore, you're providing some structure that's probably needed.
Oh, I agree.
Find without
yes.
it.
Yes.
which is sort of what I was saying in the beginning, is that this backdrop of all these fluid boundaries and, you know, behavior by people isn't what it used to be. Let's just leave it at that. There's, you know, you're providing somewhat that structure that probably is needed.
I like to think so, and we'll keep as many people fooled into that idea as possible. I'm going to move on. I'm going to take one more call, and then we should take, I don't know, do we need a break? I don't know. I'll ask that opinion in a minute. Thank you again, Ontario. Awesome place.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Awesome in that my friends who do all their media theory live right there on this crazy little island, Knoxville, Tennessee. Roger, is that you?
Hi, it's Diana.
Hi, Diana. Thank you for your infinite patience. You're the last person in a long queue. This is on for an hour and a half. Talk to me. Talk to us.
I know. It was all very interesting. But my comment is back at what you were talking about way at the beginning. You were talking about hormones and et cetera. And I was putting a bit all together with the diet. And how important it is, because the whole lie about cholesterol, how we actually need cholesterol because that's what makes our hormones and that's what makes our brain. And then I realized that the internet, because of the internet, we've lost the connection to our body, like you said. That was a great insight, and it was a great insight for me, and I really appreciate that. We've done the same thing with food. We don't eat real food anymore. We don't spend any time paying attention to what it is that we put into our body. We even have we almost have a virtual diet. And
Go ahead. I'm squirming in my chair. But keep going. Yes.
Oh, to me,
yes.
It's just so important.
Yes.
Yes, it's just so important because the lies that are perpetrated, you know, by the medical profession, et cetera, they're telling us to have this low-fat diet. It's been a lie since the beginning. And then they have these extra statin drugs that lower your cholesterol even more. And because of that, there's a 300% likelihood that you're going to have Alzheimer's if you have a low-fat diet. And, I mean, to me, that is all part of the whole internet problem. You're separated from your body. You're separated from your food. You don't have any grounding. You don't have any boundaries. Some of the same things that other people have been saying. But to me, it's really organic, all the way down into all the little bacteria that we've killed in our gut biome because
glyphosate.
We have antibiotics
glyphosate.
Because WebMD told us to take them.
Oh, or glyphosate. I mean, you know, the thing with glyphosate is it's perfectly fine for complex mammals. Except for their gut flora, which regulates your immune system. So it's, there's much different types of critters than you living in your intestines who are part of you. And the glyphosate is designed to kill. Its purpose is to kill, and that is one of the things that it kills.
Mm-hmm.
So check this out. This sheds some light. This astrology is always presenting me with riddles, and one of the riddles is that right now, any astrologer is going to know this is happening. The Uranus-Aries conjunction is happening in Aries. It's still exact. It's still only about 15, one quarter of a degree apart, 15 arc minutes. Moving into the conjunction right now, today, as we speak, is Ceres, in Greek times known as Demeter, among many things, the goddess of agriculture, food. Ceres is the root
and
of
also,
the word cereal.
I was just going to say, and also it wasn't apple that Eris threw to disrupt everything.
Well, it was made of gold.
Still, it represents food.
It does. It was in the form of food, and some versions, I guess it's a golden ball, but it's usually known as the apple of discord. And, of course, that apple makes its appearance in the book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Right, where it's an apple, allegedly an apple that screws everything up, and also offered by a woman.
And it is also an Apple iPhone.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It is also an Apple iPhone that put us all into the astral plane of the internet.
Ah! Oh, Jesus. That's hilarious.
Isn't
you're good, you're good at this. okay, so Ceres is now in the conjunction. It's a triple conjunction right now of dwarf planet Ceres, dwarf planet Eris, and Uranus. So I've been looking for this nourishment food angle on involving Ceres, and the digital impact on food is a vitally important issue. I mean, I watch these commercials. You know, I'm one of these people who organically hates commercials because I can't stand to hear people lying. So I've got to make up reasons to like them, which is like, well, it's work for actors. Oh, she looks like an interesting person. Maybe, you know, hey, she's got work. You know, she's an actor. They get paid every time the commercial goes on. Marshall McLuhan says, you got to really appreciate the commercials more. So I've been watching the commercials carefully, and I'm amazed at how they make these hamburgers look like deities on these fast food commercials. And it's like you get a chicken sandwich and a burger sandwich and French fries and a drink and dessert for $5. And I think I've got it tough with 50,000 free astrology sites and me trying to collect my $11 a month from people so I can make payroll and keep the lights on. And they're giving away, these fast food companies are giving away the whole meal for $5. And of course, if you've seen Supersize Me, you know what happens to you if you eat that shit for a month. You come close to death. Morgan Spurlock's doctors thought he might never recover from a month of McDonald's.
Yes.
Just a month. So spread that out over, you know, 10 years where you eat, a month of McDonald's food spread out over 6 months. So Ceres is getting in the act, and that is a brilliant analysis, to look at it as the impact of digital on the body and our relationship to food. One of the reasons I live where I live, despite a couple of good reasons to not live here, but one of the very good reasons to live here is that there is food production all around me. There are local farms in covering the countryside, and there's water. So there are farmers markets practically every day of the week within a 20-minute drive. And I cannot imagine living in a place without access to real food. And when I can, I want to know the person who grew the food. This buddy of mine is the honey guy, and he services all the farms up and down the east side of the Hudson with beehives, and then he collects all the honey. So he makes sure that their crops are pollinated, and then he collects all this honey. So he's got a great bunch of products, but he personally collects it. No machines or assistants. He runs up and down the river and he extracts tons and tons of honey. So this is really important, I think, to make the human connection with food. Now, for most people, this is absolutely impossible to do, to have a human connection to your food. Most people don't know how to cook anymore. The cooking is becoming a kind of a lost skill. It's like this, it's like this sort of priestly esoteric knowledge, like how to actually make your own macaroni and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Just making a 10-course meal. I mean, just, good old mac and cheese.
I think it's connected to that loss of identity that you mentioned. You know, you used to be a cheesemaker, and now you can't make cheese on the internet. I mean, you could sell cheese on the internet, but you can't really make cheese on the internet. So you don't, it's kind of like, who am I? I don't have to cook. I don't have to make anything. In my virtual identity, I don't have any boundaries. And
on my playlist.
Yeah,
you start to identify things with, like, this construction on Facebook, this construction on Hulu, whatever your preference is. You know, am I the movies that Netflix recommends to me? I mean, every now and then I get something interesting. But it's, not that exciting. I mean, really.
Yeah.
You know, and there's, you know, limitations. I could make a movie. So the food connection is huge. Now, one interesting thing about the digital is that all new media retrieve from previous eras. And one of the things that the digital era is doing is, though it's a much smaller population, precipitating, for example, a revolution of cheesemakers, candle makers, butchers. It seems that the most, as I mentioned, I think, to Charlie, the most dependable jobs we can get now are the ones that existed 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the older the work, if you're a young person wondering what the heck you should do, find something that was done 500 years ago. Now, it may not, you know, I think people are all dreaming they're going to get hired by Facebook. You know, they're going to get out of college and then Mark Zuckerberg is going to bring them on for $250,000 a year with no concept of what they actually have to do to deserve that money from the viewpoint of Facebook's HR department.
Yes.
I go through this with recruits to Planet Waves who don't necessarily connect with the fact that, well, you're drawing a paycheck from a finite resource. You must produce something that at least pays your way. And then, according to Marx, I'm supposed to make a profit on people's labor. That I'm so waiting for that to come true. That'll be an awesome day. But the disconnect between productivity and pay is huge. Now, this can come back to graduating from undergraduate education with $100,000 in debt. If you had said that to me and my classmates when we were in university in the 80s, we would have looked at you like you were fucking insane. That was medical school. Yeah, okay, $100,000 for med school, fine. You're going to be making that every year or 6 months as a doctor, but for undergraduate education?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that advanced. I mean, if you gave me a student, give me a freshman, I could probably give them their whole undergraduate education in like 2 years. I need someone to help me teach math, assuming anyone even cared. So I'd need a math tutor. The rest of it I can handle in much less than 4 years. You don't fucking need 4 years of that to get what you come out of your undergraduate education. It is certainly not worth $100,000 for a state education. You can graduate from a private school and you can be $200,000 in for your undergrad.
For information that's about 50 years old.
Basically, yes. You know, hopefully there are places where you can participate, but, you know, and get, you know, if you bring, it's the same with the internet and with pot and with sex. If you bring creativity, you get a creative result, right? Pot does not make anyone creative, but if you're an artist and you take one toke of weed, you might see the sculpture in the piece of rock. You know what I mean? You're not necessarily going to just flip on, you know, a cartoon and watch it. So the creativity you bring to the internet and that you bring to your education and to your life is the thing that feeds you back. You bring that creativity, but it's, I think, getting in some ways more difficult to connect that, partly because there's so much diffusion. The concept of caring, the emotional concept of caring, has changed radically, what it means to care.
Yes.
It used to be a bigger investment. And I think that inevitably, unless we're crushed and we're having to spend the next 4 years hiding Mexicans in our homes and Muslims in our homes, when Mr. Gestapo himself, Donald Trump, who's thriving on Twitter consciousness. He's thriving. Trump's whole game is based on the fact that people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless we're spending the next 4 years having the Underground Railroad protecting Mexican immigrants and preventing Muslims from being burned at the stake, which would be grounding. Would be grounding, I think. I don't think we have to go that way. We have the option to invest ever more creativity into what we're doing, and we're going to hit bottom on this, wow, I feel so empty, what happened? But when you add the total drain of the digital realm and the drain of certain medications, the drain of cholesterol, people living for, you add all these things up, you add a sex phobia that I've never seen or even read the like of. I mean, this is Wilhelm Reich. I really wish I could tell the story of our current era to Wilhelm Reich. The thing is that Wilhelm Reich told me the story, the only person from the Vienna Psychoanalytic Group who actually understood sex and said something about it. That part of the disorientation is people's radically shifted understanding of what their body is for. And in that environment, sex can be terrifying. The mere looking at someone and smiling can be considered a violation.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? Somebody once joked that Seattle is the only city in the world where when you smile at a woman, she picks up her phone and dials 911. Now, suddenly, that has expanded. Sorry if you're from Seattle and find that offensive, but it was from a sex teacher who traveled the world, and he said that was what he, that was his experience of Seattle, that it was so politically correct that no one was even allowed to smile. Well, I have some confidence that at a certain point we're going to hit bottom. The problem is bottom is sticky because the bottom has got all this toxins laying on it. And the further you go down, the harder it is to get back up.
Yeah. We're not going to be able to let anyone else get in touch with our bodies until we're able to get in touch with our own bodies. And we're not going to be able to keep from feeling empty or feeding our creativity if we're not even feeding our brain. I mean, there's all kinds of research showing that children are not as intelligent now because they don't eat breakfast. I mean, it's all of that, everything that we're saying, it all has to be taken out of that astral plane of the internet and brought back into our bodies. That what you just said about the conscious use of the tools mitigating their damage, to me, that is the best thing that's been said all day. It's the consciousness. If you don't feed your brain the appropriate things, whether that's food for your body or food for your thinking or expression of what it is that you have as a creative urge within you, then you are not awake. I mean, conscious means awake. It means aware, not in the zombie apocalypse of your cell phone.
Yes. I had a shocking experience. I was in Manhattan the other night to see Laurie Anderson talk about her creative process. And the west side of Manhattan is gnarly and nasty at 5 o'clock. It's really among the least pleasant experiences you can have driving a car. And I turned onto 6th Avenue, and this woman, 6th Avenue at that part of Manhattan is about, six lanes wide. And highly unpredictable traffic. And she's strolling across 6th Avenue looking at her phone. Apparently, this is commonplace. It was the first time I had seen this. I'm a little naive. I don't get out much. But really, walking across 6th Avenue looking at your fucking telephone, this is concrete, solid evidence that people are living in a dream. You would only do that in a dream. Were there rationality? And so the Pluto and Capricorn piece of this is that the bottom is kind of falling out on reason and rationality, i.e. you can't tell what's true and what's not true. Well, okay, so how about truth is a relative thing, basically, and at least on our plane of reality? I'm not talking about in the Course in Miracles sense of absolute cosmic truth and all that. I mean that we navigate, basically, I call it on the basis of true enough, as I say up in Canada. Oh, that's true enough. It gets the job done, right? How precise does your screwdriver need to be to assemble a table? Well, you can use 5 different screwdrivers, right? If you're inside of a computer, there's only really going to be one screwdriver that's going to get that job done. So true enough, how about that, you know? How about the necessary ability to orient yourself in the 4 directions just so you can get to true enough?
Yeah, if you don't know who you are, you're not going to be able to decide for yourself what's true or not true for yourself. And the internet provides limitless information, but just like someone else previously said, it's just because somebody wrote something down does not make it true. And we have to be able to use our own intuition and our own internal guidance, as well as our own fact-checking capabilities, to be able to do what's true and what's not true. And I believe people just don't do that anymore. If it has the most likes, then that makes it true. Or if there's more people that followed that website, you know, then that makes it true. And we know that that's ridiculous. Just because you're popular doesn't mean that you're right.
Well, we have gone into fact verification by popularity contest is the current mode.
Yes, and that's deadly because it's the same thing with the whole cholesterol and the doctors. I mean, the doctors were saying that the cholesterol is bad for you and that we need to have a low-fat diet, and what they were doing is shrinking and killing people's brains. So now we have, I don't know, an epidemic of Alzheimer's and dementia just because people think having a high-fat diet is bad for you. And that everybody, I mean, if you do the least little bit of research, you can find out that that's what your brain is made out of.
Yeah.
That's what your hormones are made out of.
This starts with Crisco, by the way. This whole
no
fat is better because they invent partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, which basically means fat that can stand up at room temperature. Like a block of Crisco, butter is that way. It's got a very low melting point, but it's at least it's a naturally made thing. It's not rendered through a chemical transformation process. It's just likely physically altered cream.
Yes.
Okay, so Crisco begins this campaign. There's an article on the old Planet Wave site about the history of Crisco, one of the most ingenious marketing campaigns in the world, where they convinced everyone to get rid of butter. And I was at least lucky that I lived in a household where we believed in the original thing is better.
Yes.
You know, we weren't falling for the newfangled thing. Now, there's plenty of people who still think that margarine is better and who don't realize that high fructose corn syrup clogs their arteries. It does the very thing that people were claiming cholesterol did. So if you're drinking ordinary soda, you are building up arterial plaque. It's pretty much the fastest way to do it, probably besides smoking cigarettes. And if you do both, probably I'm going to get rid of one of them or both. Now, the thing with fact-checking is, you know, I had the Wikipedia argument with my dad some years ago, and he said, well, Wikipedia is, you know, it's inaccurate. I said, well, the thing is that they require footnotes, and either the statement checks out against the footnote or it doesn't. It's no different than the Encyclopedia Britannica. You just have to spend a lot of time clicking on footnotes, but the phone does not facilitate that. The phone cuts out that layer. You can do it, but it's not convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're trying to verify something, it's in the physical environment of a 24-inch screen is much more convenient than the physical environment of a 4-inch screen to do the kind of verification that you need to do. But you just follow back, you look at the talk page. There's ways to do all of this. But, you know, as Adrian Rich said, there are methods, but we don't use them.
Exactly.
All right. Len Wallach is back. I'm going to go to the next call. Please do stay in touch.
Thank you.
Yes, love. Leonard.
Hi. I'm smiling at you from Seattle here.
Hi.
I just wanted to take
a
moment.
I'm a man. I'm not offended by someone smiling at me.
I just want to take a moment to give the listeners the data for the iPhone chart so that they can kind of bring it up themselves. This is from you, that you got from Anatoly.
Yep.
Tuesday, January 9, 2007, 14 minutes after 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time in San Francisco, California. So that you mentioned that, and I thought it was a very good mention. And I also want to acknowledge everybody else who's commented today. It's been a brilliant listen, but I wanted to provide that to the listeners so they can bring up that chart for themselves.
Okay, let's verify that. It's 1907, 9:14 a.m. PST in San Francisco.
Yeah, January 9, 2007, 9:14 a.m., San Francisco, California. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll send this phone chart, not a phone yet, to Amy. We'll put it up on the resources page. And this chart just blew my mind. I mean, first of all, Neptune. Why don't we just give a short tour of this? Neptune in Aquarius rising. I mean, is there a better chart to imply the merger of the digital sphere and the astral plane?
Oh yeah.
Right, so Aquarius is rising, and Neptune was in Aquarius then, and Neptune is only a little more than 2 degrees away from the horizon. So it's rising. It is like the topical theme of the chart. Also notably, the moon is void of course in Virgo. So it's not always true that you can't get something done with the moon void of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a bizarre lottery. The moon void of course means the moon has gone through, mainly means the moon is at the end of a sign. And that it's not going to make more aspects until it's in the new sign. So it's basically done. So the old term for that is void of course. And the moon is void, of course, in Virgo, one of the two main signs connected with technology, the other being Aquarius. And it's almost as if they have no idea what they're about to unleash. The effect is going to be, it's an unknown effect. That's basically what the void, of course, moon is implies, that we don't know what's going to happen here. I believe Star Wars was premiered during the void, of course, moon. According to the best research I could do, the L.A. opening for Star Wars had the moon void, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Eris piece. Okay, so there is a conjunction of Mercury and the Sun in Capricorn. They are working with structure. Clearly, you need a very highly organized technical and production team to create one of these things. You can't just wing it, right? The thing's got to work. So it seems like all of the structure, all of the programming is being taken over by people on the other side of the digital divide, which I consider not those who are content literate, but those who are structure literate. There are the users of the internet and there are the makers of the internet. And so currently, you know, we're experiencing this collapse of structure due to Pluto and Capricorn. Pluto, by the way, was in Sag for this. Perfect.
Galactic core.
On the galactic core, with Mars conjunct, perfect for the introduction of a new religion.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. That's it. We've met God, and it is the iPhone. But Sun and Mercury are exactly square Eris. So it is
exactly
a gleaming Eris chart, particularly Mercury. It's only a few arc minutes away, and it's descriptive of the kind of anarchy that's going to be unleashed by this.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally have an iPhone that I like. I'm on my third one, and I always lost my old ones. Now I've got it's connected properly, and it's more fun when it's integrated. I'm not against the things, but you know, we have to acknowledge the anarchy for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely is, it's just run everyone through the blender. There's more, this chart deserves a whole article. The Chiron, Eris, Venus, Pallas conjunction.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't even have words, so how do you even delineate that? But it's, you can see what it says.
Nessus is also conjunct Venus.
Yep, it's Pallas, Nessus, Venus, Chiron in Aquarius.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a selfie to me.
I guess, but think about the politics of technology and the way that, you know, the technology has shaped law and politics. Like, remember the huge fuss over the iPhone from the San Bernardino guy, and the FBI cracked it, and they lost their own crack, and then they tried to make Apple provide the crack. Apple said, fuck you. Then some hacker came up with it. Some hacker came up with it. They got one of their informants, basically, to hack the phone. You know, the unforeseen impact on law. The how much information do we have in our phone? Well, it would seem to me that would be perfectly subject to the Fourth Amendment protection against unlawful searches and seizures. The problem is it's neither paper nor in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The Fourth guarantees security of your home and your papers from unreasonable searches and seizures. But you've got the phone. I've heard of people getting arrested for possession of bootleg CDs. Like you make copies of all your CDs and you drive around with them in the car. That's amazing. And since when is that a criminal matter rather than a civil matter? I could see manufacturing copies being a criminal matter, but you're allowed backups of your own data, which means you can keep your backups in the car. So what about what's on your phone? So the issue, again, of where the boundary of self is radically altered by the fact that now a great many people carry around all their data in their pocket or access to all their data by way of cloud storage with them at all times. That's insane.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I like having my corporate records locked in a room behind my other room. And I know who's got the code to my door. I don't want that in my fucking pocket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nor do I need it, really. All right, so thanks, Glenn. We've got one more call, and I guess we're not taking a break since we're getting near the end of our 3 hours. But I'm interested in other viewpoints. Actually, let's take the last half hour. Let's talk to Invermere, B.C., and thanks again, Lynn. Invermere, B.C., and then we will go to the written comments, and we'll pick out some of them. Hi, from British Columbia.
Hi, I'm on speakerphone. This is Jan. Is this okay?
Sounds good. Yeah, you sound good.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm really enjoying this, and I got a real kick out of listening to your last caller, the lady who spoke and associated the logo of Apple computers with
the
golden
Discord.
Apple of Discord.
Oh, my God. That's
warrior
that gets a letter to Melanie Reinhardt, who's the planetary genius of coming up with those things. But she gets a lot of her best ideas from people in the audience, and there's a good reason for that.
That was incredible. Just came out of left field.
Yep.
Incredible. And I'm really interested in all of those nutritional aspects that she was speaking about as well. But what I had wanted to touch on was, I'm a real slow learner to do with tech, you know. So for me, the business I'm in goes back, I can remember in 2000 being in an office where we had dial-up internet, right?
Yeah.
We didn't even have high-speed internet, and there were half a dozen people in the office, and only one could access it at once, you know. So there's been a real learning curve there, and a real pressure also to get up to speed as quickly as possible, because that's how business is carried on, right? And the more savvy you are, and the faster you are, and the more you can use, the more successful you will be. Like when you talk about using internet for artistic pursuits, I also come from a print media background, and I just love when I'm doing advertising just to go sit with my production person and see what a whiz kid, you know, he or she is at putting together my ad, et cetera, because they're just so much smarter and faster than I. So
at
I really
devices,
see all the
that
advantages. And for me, it's been difficult to actually keep up. And it's a, you know, I mean, I'm 62 and a half years old, you know, so I'm keeping up, but barely.
Right. Right. Well, it's hard even for people in tech with a tech team to keep up.
Yeah. I think it is.
I used to be great at installing POP3 email on computers. I could do it in I had a little game. I could install an email account in like 30 seconds. Well, it suddenly came to the point where I couldn't do it anymore, and nothing really changed except that the operating system changed, and I just got fed up with having to deal with the changes in the invisible portion of the operating system. I was doing everything right, so now Anatoly sets up email on all of our computers remotely from the Ukraine. We just give him access, and it takes him 30 seconds. I can't do it.
Right.
The structure, when Planet Waves began, it was web and email and telephone. That's what we were anchored in.
Exactly. And that was, for me, I kind of got stuck there for a while as well, where I really did not want to advance too far beyond that. I was using email constantly for everything. And I can remember like 10 years ago being on a vacation. My former partner and I used to love going down to Merida in Mexico and hanging out there. And in January in Merida, Mexico, there would be a week-long literary music festival where the downtown square would be shut down to vehicular traffic. And you could just hang around in the square and watch people hanging out. And all of the local kids, probably the most well-off, sophisticated local kids in Merida, would all be hanging out with their phones. I don't know if they were iPhones then or what they were, texting each other. And I didn't know what the heck they were doing, actually. It had to be explained to me. What's going on here? What is...
Yeah, they're sitting in the same room texting.
Exactly. No, and they're sitting outside because, you can sit on a park bench and be watching all the crowds of people. And all these people are just texting, texting, texting. They might be texting the person next door to them, sitting next to them on the park bench for all I know. But it was kind of it was really new to me. And I had a little bit of resistance towards using it in my own life. And what I have really thought about a lot in the last 5 years when it became, it can be a vehicle for people to lie to each other,
it's much easier to lie when you don't have to make eye contact and when you don't subject yourself to accountability, when you don't show up and have to respond in real time.
Exactly. And, you talk about how the internet has created a situation of people being disembodied in a way. Well, I really see that happening, and especially when when people get into that other version of texting called sexting, which is really exciting, and a lot of people, I think, really enjoy it and did enjoy it. Now, I've seen programs on Canadian television. There's a documentary program called Doc Zone that has been a special that has been done on high school kids in the Fraser Valley outside of Vancouver, British Columbia, where really, no one does anything besides text or sext. So you brought up the situation of someone will call 911 if someone smiles at them. But conversely, there are children who are coming into the age of, sexual maturity where they can't really experience attraction to someone without getting it on an iPhone.
Or if they do experience attraction to someone in physical form, physical sex has been almost entirely conflated with rape.
Or it's just such a sophisticated, extreme form of porn that, I would not have even known what it was when I was 13, 14, 15 years old.
Known what was?
What they're getting. in terms of what they can send each other and what they do send each other on their iPhones, texting each other.
Well, a lot of times they're violating kiddie porn laws.
Yeah.
So one person can
even though they
test out their group. And the purpose of kiddie porn laws was not to protect young people from sharing each other, you know, playing doctor, or sending pictures of each other's junk, as they call it. The idea was to prevent exploitation by people older, more powerful, and more sophisticated. And every now and then you hear, it seems to have calmed down, where the principal will gang up with the sheriff and they'll prosecute for sex crimes. And so
right. This
is partly what I mean by sex is being conflated with rape. The digital sex is being conflated with pornography, basically is the same thing. And physical sex is so threatening to so many young people that mere attraction is creepy. That's the word they use. This is creepy.
Right. So you haven't really touched on this as yet in this program, but I just thought I would throw it out there because it's really a brave new world in that respect, I think, and it must be for kids.
Yes, with very little disorientation. I said to a younger friend of mine that, you basically don't remember when sex play was a normally transacted thing that was not completely associated with violation and with paranoia. But as someone who came of age in the 70s, I have a whole other orientation on what is appropriate human behavior. And this is true of almost all young people have a kind of exaggerated sense of the impact of sex, which is then cut off and plenty of reckless activity ensues. It's not like people are not doing things, but it seems to be with ever either less consciousness or it's considered some form of porn or rape. And these are very dangerous boundaries to blur. Use the symbol of something versus the reality of it, and to confuse healthy attraction, like affirmative loving attraction, with attack tantamount to murder. I mean, it's almost like saying there's no difference between petting a kitten and strangling it. You would think, well,
I know what you're saying there. But from what I've heard, the actual brain pathways do change for people who utilize this as a tool.
I've seen that TED Talk. Is that one place you heard of this? Was that TED Talk?
No, I haven't. I don't know that I've seen it there.
One of the worst pieces of. Go ahead, and then I'll give you my editorial comment. Not that you asked for it.
Yeah, well, go ahead. I mean, that's great, but I'm just commenting on what I've heard and actual commentaries from support groups for people who are wanting to get themselves free of getting all sexual gratification off of the internet
because they have become so addicted
to it and really that they can't seem to have any normal response to a real person, a real live person.
Well, I'm interested in seeing those studies. I think that and also self-reporting is not going to be entirely reliable here because it's not necessarily getting to the background cause of that problem. And in terms of rewriting neurology, I mean, you have to be careful anytime somebody uses the word wired when they're talking about neurology. Because there are no wires in your brain. And so that's one clue. Anytime you hear someone talking about...
Speaking metaphorically.
I get it, but we need good metaphors. We need metaphors that are appropriate. And especially when we're talking about something as sublime as brain response to things.
Yeah.
Most people don't even know
the correct biological terms to use, you know, whether it's brain synapses or how the brain neurology works. I certainly don't.
But the neurologist should know. But the theorist should know. The person standing on the stage at TED who talks about getting hardwired from porn. Well, hardwired is the Ethernet cable going across my floor that I connected so that my computer could be hardwired into my router so that I eliminated the variable of the Wi-Fi network in my house.
Right,
so
yeah.
So that I could be on a dependable connection. That's hardwired. I took a wire out of the closet and I plugged one end into the modem and one end into the computer and they both went click. That's not
right.
How the brain works. It's much more flexible. And I'm not saying these don't have an effect. Now, the effect we're not looking at is the effect of the screen itself and not the content of the screen. And from what I have read from people I consider to be thoughtful and reliable, the impact of the screen itself is far more profound than any possible content of the screen. Porn, the badger, honey badger video, the cat playing the piano video, doesn't matter. It is the screen itself, the reliance on the screen, the relationship to the screen, the impact on society. And I know this sounds a little weird at first, but it's not when you start to look at, for example, one study that McLuhan cite, where people were shown, two groups were shown the same content, the same movie, only one was shown the movie on a thing projected onto the wall, like in a movie theater, and the other was shown the content through a cathode ray tube where the image was shot at them, right?
I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
Oh, okay, so a cathode ray tube, like a TV set. On a TV set, the projector is in front of you, and you're looking at the projection onto a screen that's being shot in your face. When you're in a movie theater, the movie projector is above your head, being projected at the wall, you're looking at a reflection of the image.
Okay, right.
And in an experiment where the same content was shown to two equal, you know, equivalent groups, they gave completely different analyses of the content. One gave an analysis of the structure and the editing, and they leaned toward the technical analysis. The other gave an analysis of how they feel. How they responded personally to the content, the same exact content, and as close as you can get study groups to be equivalent, they had done that, and so the means of delivery seems to be the thing that changes the mind more than the content. And
is
so,
that
for example,
similar to the difference between reading something on a printed page and reading it on a screen? Because I know for myself, I find that reading something on a printed screen after a while fatigues my eyes and I guess my brain too, more than reading something on the printed page. Or is there something lost?
Well, it's a whole different kind of reading. I mean, I can't read a book or a newspaper without a pen or pencil in my hand.
Right.
There is no way to take notes on a Kindle book. Now, some have that little thing where you can do that, but you're still on a grid. You still aren't scribbling. You're still not writing around the bottom corner. When you're writing in pencil on a page, when you're annotating a physical object, it's much more a personal reflection of your thoughts and how you're feeling that day. And I would say they're radically different. I practically insist that anyone who's studying astrology with me get a printer and work on printed charts that you make your own rather than staring at a screen where it's this abstraction. It doesn't really exist in tangible form, and therefore it's much more difficult to take possession of the intellectual content of that because it's just floating on a thing. If there's a blackout, it's gone.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. Anytime I've had to study anything, I can't do it without having a highlighter and just scribbling away and hitting the most important word even in a sentence with the highlighter.
Yeah, so you're shaping the thing that you're reading by doing that. You are making it into a different piece of art. If you're just reading the same book flipping by on a screen, I would propose an entirely different experience of learning and of understanding.
So not only are you taking possession of the information in a different manner, but you're also storing it in some way in that organ inside your skull in a different way.
Sure, because the delivery method is going to speak to a different. So far as this left-right hemisphere thing is accurate, working two different sides of the brain. It is one reason why I present in so many different media. I could just, you know, when I first introduced audio, I had people revolting, telling me they were going to stop sending me money because I was doing a podcast. And I never said, oh, I'm not going to write any more articles. I'm just going to do a podcast. I never said that. I said, and now on Tuesday, you get this thing every week. Hello. Well, people were angry, not a lot, but there were some really vitriolic comments that I got. The resistance was right. But my intent is to make sure that I'm working as many different aspects of consciousness as I can. Hence, I work in every article is illustrated, right? Beautifully
right.
Illustrated. There's a reason for that, because I want to stimulate the entire brain with the artwork that we're producing. So first of all,
right.
We do pictures and text are always beautifully integrated. Then there's audio, and then there's video, and many manifestations of audio. And this is a different environment than if you can't actually talk to me or raise your hand. Right? So I think that this is my choice as a digital artist, is to use as many channels as possible and to keep them more or less in balance and to be good at them and to know what message is appropriate for what medium. What venue do I deliver that in, as opposed to some other way to put it?
Right.
And
well,
I personally think this is what we need. This is more of this type of thinking, the critical use of thought and of the many structures we have available to us with the internet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, it's huge. It's just huge. I mean, I was thinking about the Ehrlich syndrome. That it's used on people who have dyslexia, and it's a way of putting a colored glasses on or a colored screen over top of a printed page so that the eyes actually track better and can read easier without getting all the letters jumbled up or the eyes just getting fatigued. Who knows what that is all about, you know?
Well, I'm reading The Laws of Media, the sequel to Understanding Media. By the way, if you're thoughtful about any of this, go get yourself a copy of Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan, 1964, where he takes you through the entire history of everything up, not the entire, but an erudite summary of each of the most prevalent forms of media up till the time of the book's publication. And he was aware of computers at that time. The
yeah.
sequel comes out maybe 14 years later called Laws of Media. Today I was just reading about what they think dyslexia is. So McLuhan reasoned that print heavily colonizes the left brain. Left brain equals right side of the body, which is the logic reason side of the brain. To be able to
right.
make that sentence work, you have to read those letters in order. You have
right.
to read the, you have to be able to track syntax to analyze what that means. By the way, I'm
right.
about to do this with the Second Amendment soon. I solved the riddle. I'm pleased to announce here, solved the riddle of the Second Amendment last night. And you have to use syntax and logic. Now, what McLuhan is saying is that when broadcast media came along, the broadcast media dumps right into the right brain. It jumps into the cubist simultaneity of experience, Eastern mysticism side of the brain. And he's saying that dyslexics are unintentional cubists. Cubism is a form of art where you have multiple viewpoints at once. Hence, you can't look at the page and see it one way. You look at the page and the page is constantly changing. That's because you're trying to read the printed page with the side of the brain that's much more suited for watercolor painting.
Yeah, or playing music.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. not yeah. reading music on the page. That's the whole thing. I find that to be deeply disturbing, that you would recreate music off of. I mean, it's fascinating to know what these symbols all are, the little fermatas and codas and quarter notes and half notes and all that stuff. But it's kind of weird. But we wouldn't have Bach if not for that.
Huh. Okay.
Right, the talking leaves preserved, right? Beethoven wrote it down.
Right.
That's a good bumper sticker. Like,
oh,
what?
Well.
Beethoven wrote it down? Seriously? This is some wacko. I'm going to pass this person.
Well, it's just going round and round. It's like a great big fat onion. One layer after another after another. And every layer you peel off, there's another one.
Though I think there's a core of the onion, and there's definitely a skin of the onion. So that's an organized model of seeking, right, to go deeper.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't lead nowhere. Eventually, it leads to the onion core, to the germ inside that's going to make the new onion plant. So it does have a destination.
Good enough.
It would be easier for us if we were to keep track of these effects as we experience them, rather than just letting ourselves get bombed, which is pretty much what we do. We're like a little Vietnamese village and the planes come and bomb us. That's what this technology is.
Yeah, I know. And that, you know, I mean, it would be like living your life as a reporter. At some point, you just have to live your life and experience it and take it in, right? You can't be annotating it and writing it down and analyzing it all at the same time, even though on a very complex level, of course, we are, right? Because that's what the brain does. But it's all happening so quickly. And we get sidetracked and distracted by doing selfies of ourselves the whole time we're doing it. That's
well,
the whole other
and a
thing.
Good, a good reporter, I took a selfie at the beginning of the call with Henrietta on my lap, which I'll put on the resources page. You can see me and my friend Henrietta, who always gets cuter. Wait, what was the thought right before that? Before I got completely sidetracked by the idea of a selfie, we had the onion. The onion leads somewhere. You get to the core of the onion, and then what was next? Well, let it fly. Let's see. So we're at the end of our 3 hours here, and there's a lot of people in this class, and I would encourage you to take part in the discussion list. You can reply to these emails. There's a good old-fashioned, maybe remember the old major domo discussion groups. That's what this is. Everyone who's in the class is on the list. You can just request to be taken off the list. If you don't want to get the email, there often isn't much, but I would love to keep this conversation going. And you know, let's pry a little more into some of this astrology is. For example, we didn't get into the essence of the Mars station direct in Scorpio. Now, I'm planning to focus all of my stuff for the next week on prepping the Mars station and getting into that moment of aligning with what you want. And this is going to really take honesty. You can't pretend to want or not want and still align in an accurate way. You really have to get in there on the level of your feelings and your will and know. So I'm going to offer some thoughts about that in over the next few days, and then I'm going to take a week out of this awesome hockey game that we're in. Thank you very much. What was your name from BC?
Jan.
Jan. All right.
Yes.
Thank you again for your
yes.
thoughts and
Thanks.
Contributions. Let's cut her off before she finished. All right. So thank you. This has been beautiful, and I have learned so much in this conversation. You all have participated, and you've helped Planet Waves get through one of our slow months of the year. Thank you for your support and for being part of this community that we are doing all the time to make sure there is a safe, sane, loving, friendly, perhaps not safe if you're threatened by ideas, but hey, that's part of life is ideas. And we've been doing this 18 years on the internet. I started in December 1998 as Planet Waves. I ran it on Rob Brezhne's site for about 6 months. I did a series of articles on Rob's site, the old site called Real Astrology, and then did that all from Europe, and then came back to the States and started what now is Planet Waves, with the intention of creating the reader-sponsored project. So I would encourage you to please get a subscription if you're not a subscriber. Most of the people who come to these are already subscribers, though it is essential that we be able to do what we do year-round. We're not really seasonal. We have to be ready, and everyone has to have eaten before they come to work at Planet Waves, like every other workplace. So I would encourage you to help us out by being a subscriber, get the benefits of that, of which there are plenty, and to contribute other ways. If you have ideas, if you're a writer, I would love to cultivate some people in my method of news writing and astrojournalism. It takes work to learn this. Writing is now harder than it ever was because of our kind of failure of rationality, but you can get it back pretty quickly. It's a little like riding a bicycle. Seeing no other thoughts, I'm available by way of the list, or you can email me at efc@ericfrancis.com. I was scanning through the Q&A. I didn't see anything I could immediately respond to. There were some complex thoughts, things about attention span and stuff like that. I'll do my best to find the most appropriate venue, probably the list, to respond to those things. Thank you, Amy, over in England, for helping run this whole shebang in the background, and other people who help, especially Anatoly and others who keep the web infrastructure running. And that is all I have to say for now. Write to me if you have any further thoughts. This has been absolutely beautiful, and I'll catch you all on a different day.